Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're going to bring you now one of our continuing conversations with people who won the Democratic nomination, other nominations for Baltimore City Council, and with eight new council people, seven of whom I think are really brand new to this kind of politics, and offer something very new. We're going to about to talk to Christopher Burnett, who won the Democratic nomination for the 8th City Council District, where Helton Holton retired, and he's a community organizer. Chris, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure. A
little background. Community organizer for who?
So I've worn several hats. I got started in college at University of Maryland College Park with an organization called Community Roots, which was a student-run social justice group. We started an after-school program, a Feed the Workers program. We advocated for living wages for our campus workers, tried to get the university to divest from Maryland Correctional Enterprises, and several other campaigns along the way, which actually changed the trajectory of my life because I was initially went there to become a physical therapist. I left with a degree in African-American studies and public policy. Parents weren't too excited at first, but they trusted me, and you know, they wanted me to follow my heart and my passion. Went to grad school, but got involved with a lot of things swirling in the city. One of my mentors early on was Betty Robinson, a longtime
activist. Oh, sure. I know Betty very well.
And after finishing grad school at UMBC, I called my grandmother, who was an activist with SMEAC, Save the Middle East Action Committee.
What's her name?
Shireen Burnett.
Oh, yeah.
She was the VP of at one point. We lost our home on
Wolf. Good roots.
Chase. Yeah. Well, you know, and she was not a long time or seasoned activist, but she stood up and fight for her neighborhood, and that kind of really laid the foundation for me to want to be a part of something bigger than myself. So after finishing grad school, first job out of college was at Service Employees Union, SEIU 1199. I ran the Good Jobs, Better Baltimore campaign, which focused on local hiring for development, early days of trying to push to raise the minimum wage. We got involved in the Harbor Point TIF and pushing for a community benefits agreement and the BG&E Exelon merger. And that time also got involved in my community association. And, you know, I live in Edmondson Village and third generation there, my wife, Vanessa.
Is that where you grew up, Edmondson Village?
My dad grew up there. We bounced around a lot, so I can't claim a single neighborhood. I did go to city schools and county schools, moved out to the suburbs, went to high school. But got involved with my association, and first big campaign that I ran there simply as a volunteer was repair the shopping center, the Edmondson Village Shopping Center. Was a big issue. It still is a big issue as far as the conditions, and I got tired of asking, frankly, the owner to do the right thing. And so we started mobilizing people around there. We did code enforcement walks. We did got students involved with cleanups. We used as much media as we could get to spotlight the issue. Folks were saying to organize a boycott, but that was a challenge because, you know, with transportation lacking in Baltimore, it was hard to move people somewhere else. So we really had to pick a fight right there on the ground. From there, I founded an organization or co-founded Neighbors Without Borders, which was sort of an umbrella effort to bring together our associations around issues or community leaders, association leaders around issues that impacted all of us. We did leadership development workshops. We did expungement workshops. And out of that work also birthed the Village Farmers Market, which I'll do a shameless plug in saying it opens again this June, first Saturday at Edmondson High School. But that came out of several conversation and visioning sessions around the lack of healthy food in Edmondson Village in West Baltimore.
So I mean, deep background on community organizing, community work. Mm-hmm. So if you win the general, I mean, Republicans don't usually have a chance in certain districts anyway.
Yeah, I take everybody seriously.
You got to take
them
seriously. So I'm curious how you view some of the things that are coming up, that will be coming up before the city council and the city. There are two major issues that will probably be on the ballot this fall. Mm-hmm. One, they're debating on how it's going to happen to diminish the power of the strong mayoralty we have in the city. Mm-hmm. By denying the vote to the two appointed members of the Board of Estimates and just leaving the three elected members. And the other is a referendum that would allow the city council to add to the budget, not just to track, which gives you a lot of power over the budget. Mm-hmm. So talk a bit about your sense of where those things were going, how that fits into your general campaign and your support and not support for those ideas.
So it was something. It wasn't two issues that I focused a lot on in the campaign.
Right. We mainly, but the Philly issues right now, they're
big
huge.
Issues. Right. They're huge issues. Right. As far as the Board of Estimates, I'm not sure that strengthens the city council. It gives more power to the council president and the comptroller. So, you know, from how does that, do I support it or not? I need more information. I mean, I think that from one end, diminishing the mayor's power is something that we should look at just to have a more balanced government in general, which I think can be good for everybody. Is the Board of Estimates the place to do it? I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think that we should look at some other way to balance that out. So, because, I mean, we know that the mayor's agenda has typically always gotten through the Board of Estimates. Whatever she wants has pretty much happened.
Right. The appointees of the mayor have two of the five votes.
Right.
She's got the third.
Sure.
Right.
Or sure.
She.
Right. So I'm much more interested in the budget issue. I think that is an area that, as a council person, you can and should have more influence over. Because what ends up happening is that right now you can only cut from the budget. And so to advocate for programming or resources for your district, it's about your relationship that you have with the mayor, frankly. And, you know, there's been issues with the current council and previous councils about, you know, not necessarily pushing back strong enough against the mayor. I mean, we saw the veto override was the first one in what, 2 or 3 decades?
Yes, right.
And so that was exciting to see that, you know, finally we're standing up and saying, look, man, this is something that, you know, youth funding, which was the issue, youth programming was a big issue, especially coming out of the uprising, and that's where we need to put our money, which will also be on the ballot in November. And so I support that. I think we should have more control over the budget. Board of Estimates, I wouldn't fight against it. But I think, like I said, it just hands more power to the council president, not necessarily more power to the council, which, you know, like I said, I guess it's up for debate on the impact that it'll really have.
With 7 of the 14 members of the council mm-hmm. being what I would call, for want of a better term, young upstarts mm-hmm. from 40 and below, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's people on the council like Mary Pat Clark, who won re-election, and a few others, Bill Henry maybe as well. Where do you see the council changing? Where do you see the main areas for this kind of new block of people? Not that you're a monolith, mm-hmm. but this new block of people coming in. Where do you see changes taking place, and what do you think the priorities should be?
So knowing a few of them pretty well, I can't say I wouldn't call them any of my best friends or anything like that, but I know I have worked with a few of the folks who won previously. And knowing them, I know that they're going to be really strong on issues like local hiring for development projects. If the minimum wage bill doesn't make it through with this current council, I can see it having an easier time getting through the new council. Knowing, you know, these folks have backgrounds in doing community organizing work, so I can see a lot more neighborhood-based issues coming to the forefront where we haven't seen that before. Youth programming. I mean, we're all young. I came up through Baltimore City Rec Center. Some of my fondest memories were at Leaf Walk Elementary after school.
Leaf Walk Elementary. I remember that rec center. One of my daughters went to that elementary
okay.
school.
Yeah, I was there. And, you know, so I know that youth programming is a huge priority for me, and I know it's for several other folks as well. And it's not even about, like, you know, a lot of the talk is we need to build more rec centers. But my focus is, okay, we can build more rec centers, but if there's barriers to getting in from the community, if there's barriers in the level of the programming, I mean, yeah, we can have more ball fields, but, like, our kids need more than that, especially when there's opportunities to bring technology in and help them compete on a greater level with the rest of the planet, frankly. You know, that was an issue that came up in one of the candidate forums. You know, should we have more workforce training or technology in after-school programs? And I'm like, well, why not both?
Right.
And the arts while we're at it. You know, let's invest right. in our young people. So I can see those being priorities where it seemed before. I don't want to speak for anyone on the council. Maybe there are reasons why these didn't come to the forefront over the last few years. But I can see this new council really being big on those areas.
So, there are a lot of issues here facing the city. And one of them is going to be it might be a fait accompli by the time you hit the council. But let's take Port Covington, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like they're steamrolling, at least from my perspective, steamrolling this TIF through,
yep.
which is huge.
Yep.
But so what does the city do? What does the city council do to leverage that? Let's say, for argument's sake, it does go through, to make it meet the needs of the city and not just build a second city across the water that is – has very little effect on the lives of people in the rest of the city.
Absolutely. And that's the thing I've been talking about a lot on the campaign trail,
yeah.
is that, you know, I don't think development in itself is inherently bad for Baltimore, but it's the things that we ask or don't ask for as a part of the deal. There should be stronger teeth behind our local hiring law so that we make sure we're putting, I mean, it's what, 20 years of construction, I believe, or 10 to 15 years. It's extensive. Sorry, I've had a hard time like getting in the weeds on it because of the campaign, but now I can start thinking about policy. And that's where my background is, so I'm excited. But, you know, we have an extensive period of time that not only can we put local folks to work, build their capacity to work on other projects, we can invest in workforce training programs, because that's the issue that developers say, is that we'd love to hire more local people, but the skill set isn't there. Well, this is the time that we invest in apprenticeship programs. We invest in workforce training and adult education programs. But also, by having stronger local hiring laws, you're giving folks opportunity to actually do the work, and so that they can carry that into the, you know, whatever trade they want to go into. I want to see more affordable housing as a part of that development. I mean, we have this so-called city within a city, and we see the same thing with Harbor Point, where folks cannot afford to stay there in Harbor East. You just cannot. There is a
well, we have inclusionary housing that has no teeth.
Right, right.
I mean, in order for it to be inclusionary housing, the city has to end up paying the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's easy to say no to it in Port Covington or Harbor East or anywhere else like that.
Right, right. But like I said, if you can't afford to stay there, then we're effectively subsidizing a project that folks in our city currently won't be able to live in. It may attract new people, and yeah, that grows our tax base. But at the end of the day, it still leaves everyone else high and dry. Prevailing wage agreements. So we say, okay, folks who are working on this project have to have a $15, $20, $25 wage that's written into the contract. So you kind of have these issues where the developers or subcontractors are bringing in folks that paying them next to nothing to do the work, slave wages basically, and not really paying wages that people can support their family. These are the things that like, and there's a lot of other stuff. I think, Dr. Brown with
Lawrence Brown.
Yeah, Lawrence Brown put
Murray
out
State University.
He put out a list of demands that I thought was very interesting, and actually got it right here in my notes.
Oh, yes. His ideas about how you develop housing
in
ways that actually are more democratic and give poor people and poor working people and working people a community and a chance for housing.
Right. But he also put out a list of demands for the Port Covington TIFT, which included issues on housing, wages, training, wanted to see a public school there, and several other things. And I've reviewed that and like, look, these are a lot of excellent ideas. And I happen to, you know, I know Dr. Brown pretty well, Lawrence Brown pretty well. And him and several other activists have, you know, been really leading the charge on changing the conversation around how we do development for a long time. And not just him. There's been several other people for years that have been pushing this issue of fair development. The United Workers come to mind as well for the work that they've done and really changing the conversation. And I think it's a good one. And, you know, but at the end of the day, we have a situation where, I think the way you worded it was correct. It's being steamrolled through by a council that's going to look dramatically different in less than a year.
Dramatically different.
And, you know, I find it disappointing that it is moving forward. Given that context.
So a couple of things before you have to roll and get through some of this. The young man who – the 13-year-old boy who was shot by the city police officer. There's arguments back and forth. We've had these discussions on the air, both in terms of understanding what the police might have gone through but understanding what this really meant to have a 13-year-old shot for carrying a BB gun that looked like a real gun. And one of the things we posited in the air was, and then I think Carl Stokes raised this during his campaign for mayor a lot, actually, was do we need to cut the police budget and invest that money either in schools or in other programs? And one of the things I suggested on the air was that we need to invest more in our schools, the city does, take more of a commitment. What that means, the money's got to come from someplace. And B, that supposing back in the 90s, the Food of Islam – had a contract with the city of Baltimore, and they patrolled the high rise, where they really did an amazing job in the period of time that they were doing that. And so why not turn some of the neighborhood security and patrol and working with people in communities to Food of Islam, Safe Streets, other organizations are already there on the ground and working in the community, might have walked up to that young boy and said, what are you doing with that? What is that in your hand? And dealt with it in an entirely different way.
Sure.
You know, and kind of create something new. I mean, how to think differently about where our city, how we can develop a sense of community.
Yeah. Well, look, I think the inherent belief that somehow police can make our neighborhood safer is, I think, a flawed way of thinking. Public safety is a public health issue. It's an issue of economics. The decision to go out there and sell drugs or carry a weapon is often an economic decision, whether it's for some folks it may be to get nicer things, for others it may be to simply support their family, and then simply once they get caught in that cycle of incarceration, it becomes harder to break it. So I think we have to look at that area first. You know, I got asked a lot, what's your public safety plan? And mine is jobs. Mine is raising the minimum wage. Mine is local hiring and workforce training programs and investing in our schools. So I totally support that. And I think also, from a neighborhood safety perspective, I agree that we need to invest more in capacity building for neighborhood groups, because I think it's a little bit short-sighted to say, well, we'll just cut it out of the budget and just write a check to XY group to do the work. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we need to vet them, too. Who are these people, and what is their training and ongoing skill set that we can really invest in? But I think it's a good way to go. I mean, we see there are neighborhood patrols that exist throughout the city that are community-led, and I think those make the biggest impact, because if you live in your neighborhood, you know who is supposed to be there and what looks odd and out of the ordinary. And most of our police force does not live in Baltimore City.
Right.
And so for them, this may be their first time ever coming to West Baltimore in their lives, frankly. And so they don't have the relationships that are already established that, say, a community association would, if we could invest in that area. I mean, that's why I did leadership development in my neighborhood, because I found that there were community leaders.
What exactly is your neighborhood?
I live in Edmonton Village.
You live in Edmonton Village?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, okay. Right behind the shopping center on Edmonton Avenue.
One of the old classic shopping centers in America.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Right. And, you know, what I found was that we have amazing community association leaders but they come from all walks of life. You know, some are bus drivers, some are teachers, one is, you know, physicists. I mean, they come from everywhere. And I felt like if I could impass on them some community organizing skills, how to do an asset map, how to build capacity, how to run a campaign from start to finish, that they could elevate the work that they were already doing, because no one is doing that. You know, you step up because you care about your neighborhood, mm-hmm. but often you don't really know where to go from there. So you're just kind of shooting in the dark, or you become over-reliant on the city to get things done. And the city's not going to solve all of our problems. I told folks that on the campaign trail. I'm not Superman, and I will not be able to do this without you. So we will have to have strong partnerships throughout my candidacy but also once I get in. Like, I want to continue these relationships. I will continue knocking on doors. I want to strengthen our neighborhood groups and have neighborhood councils that work together, because we can, when we see that kind of thing happening, they say what the squeaky wheel gets the oil, and it makes it easier for me to do my job when people are empowered to make an impact. So to answer that question, I do support investing more in neighborhood patrol groups, but I also support investing money in training and building their capacity to do the work first. It's not just a check.
So you live in the heart of the West Side, mm-hmm. in District 9.
Eight.
Eight. Yeah. I thought it was nine.
Yeah.
Eight. That's right. It's a little further over.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious what you see in your district. I mean, it's got. I mean, there's a lot in your district. There's this real mix of middle class and poverty mm-hmm. that sits in your district
within stoplights.
Right.
Yeah.
Mostly African American, but mixed.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about your district for a moment, as emblematic of where the city needs to go. We're seeing. You know, I was listening to WEA in this new Rise of Trump City series. They looked at Hamden. And one of the things that came out of the conversation about Hamden, which I thought they did a brilliant job on, that they air on our show every other Friday at 11:30, was looking at the intensity but subtlety of racism in our city, of what communities get developed and how they get developed, which I thought was really – so when I think about that, I think of the housing stock in your district. I think of the communities in your district. And so how do you change that? How do you change the investment pattern so it actually affects the black community in a positive way, and we begin to develop the outer harbor, as we used to say?
Right. So my district is very residential. We don't have a ton of commercial corridors. When I was, you know, planning my campaign, I had a lot of meetings, struggled to find a coffee shop because there isn't one in the 8th district. And so, you know, there's no place to have a sit-down meal. And I think that when we talk about from a public health lens, that's why we started the farmers market at Edmondson High School, because there's literally nothing but takeout places, at least in my corridor, or where I stay at, which is in the middle of the district. We go all the way up to Howard Park and go all the way down to, like, Beachfield, Yale Heights, close to St. Agnes Hospital.
Windsor Hills.
I mean, not St. Agnes. Windsor Hills is in there.
My old neighborhood.
Beachfield, right. Tin Hills, Huntington. I mean, you asked also just about even the the breakdown. I mean, it's very much a microcosm of Baltimore City, I would say, where you can go two stoplights. You're in wealthy neighborhoods, big giant houses, which I didn't even know existed until I was walking my dog one day when we first moved back into the neighborhood, and called my wife, and I'm like, this place looks like Little Columbia. Like, this is crazy. But then you go down a few blocks, and you're on Edmonton Avenue, where we have dense vacants, you have blight, you have violence, you have drug dealing. I mean, you have everything, despair. Like, and then talking, and also, like, knocking on doors. The thing about, one of the things I love about where I stay is people don't leave. I mean, it's amazing how often I talk to someone who's been in that same house for 30, 40, 50 years, and they remember everything about the neighborhood, how it's changed, good and bad. And they over time, they just don't go. And then they, like, right. Folks like me, like, pass it, come back into the neighborhood. And so there's very much a sense of community and pride, but also a sense that, like we said, they just have experienced the disinvestment firsthand.
So specifically, let me ask a question. Yeah. I mean, because I was one of those people, if it wasn't for a divorce, I'd probably still be living in that district in Windsor Hills. Mm-hmm. But when you think about the neighborhoods, when you think about – to me, this is emblematic of the city. Mm-hmm. Two things. A, when you think about neighborhoods like – right around Edmondson Village, where you think about Liberty Heights and Garrison, mm-hmm. you and the residential districts that surround that, mm-hmm. Walbrook Junction, wherever, those neighborhoods. When you think about the vacancy and the degradation of communities all around Edmondson Village and the highway to nowhere, right. in that community, there are two separate different issues, but they're very critical issues to the future of the city. How do you begin to develop Liberty Heights and Garrison so it is a Hamden? Sort of, so right. to speak, right? Or how do you develop – or how do you approach the abandoned housing issue so it both develops a community and people have a say in where they're going and you kind of create neighborhood again? I mean, so what are your ideas about – what are you going to bring to the council to deal with that?
Sure. So I'll start with the vacants. That's a big issue that I want to focus on
right.
A lot. And I think there's a couple areas that we can look at. One, we have to reduce the barriers for community control of land. There's a lot of folks I've talked to who, you know, wanted to get involved in the vacancy value program, but saw that, you know, you needed $60,000 in capital to just get in the door, and then there's a bidding process. And it kind of just lends itself that only developers can really get their foot in the door. And so how do we work with the mayor's office, frankly, to change that so that there are, you know, I know mayoral-elect Kathy Pugh was proposed going back to the Dollar House program.
She has a general, too.
Yeah, she has a general. As I said, elect. She's thrown that idea out. But I think whether that works or not, I think her heart's in the right place, and that we have to reduce these barriers so that communities can be the ones that are investing. I mean, there's – you know how many contractors live in the two-block radius of me that have the skills that could very much take
exactly.
over and rebuild
exactly.
a vacant house on their block, and I'm sure would have a family member that wants to move back into the neighborhood that could buy the house. And so that's an area that I want to explore, is that how do we have more community control? How do we make it so that so that it's not, you know, see all these "we buy houses" signs popping up. Those are investors. They're trying to buy it cheap, or they buy a tax sale, or someone doesn't pay their water bill, $500, they lose their house. Those are the kind of things that destabilize communities and can be demoralizing for folks. So I want to figure out, how do we reduce barriers? I also want to explore ideas, economic incentives for slumlords to invest. Right now, they pay lower property taxes than someone who mows their lawn and trims the hedges and paints and does everything that you do everything right, and you pay more every year that you invest in your house. But every year a house sits on the market or sits abandoned and the roof falls, and they actually pay less and less in property tax. Now, some will argue, well, they pay the vacant house fee, which is $900. But if the house needs $1,000 worth of work, then what's the $900?
Right.
And, you know, so how do we figure out ways to really hit slumlords hard
right.
In a way that it forces them their hand to either invest or get off the pot. And there's some work that's being done on a community level. Baltimore Renew is an effort that I've been following very closely, which is an effort to create a citywide community association that could use the Community Bill of Rights to sue slumlords and really take back control and hit them in a hard way. Because right now there's a disconnect where you can use it, the Community Bill of Rights, to stop a nuisance property or to sue a landlord. But if it's not in your neighborhood boundaries, then they get off. And so looking at what the Community Law Center is doing with community groups and supporting those kind of efforts is an area that I want to focus on. Commercial corridors. I think we have to do a lot more to support our small business owners. There are resources available. A lot of them do not know how to get access, or they don't know that they even exist. And some instances. I actually did. There was a grant available. I guess it was maybe a year or two ago, to doing facade improvements from BDC for small business owners. And I literally took it to every corner store along Edmonton Avenue and said, hey, look, they got this program. A lot of them had no idea this even existed. And so that kind of outreach needs to happen on the council level. I mean, you're very much an advocate to say, I mean, that's a small program, but it's a start that can say, look, man, there are resources here for you to invest in your property. But also holding people's hands. There needs to be more incubation. I mean, with our developing businesses so that they can say, look, this is how you navigate city bureaucracy and to get from point A to point B to start your business and sustain your business, because small businesses are what's going to turn the city around. They're more likely to hire local, they're more likely to pay a fair wage, and they're more likely to reinvest in the surrounding community than a corporation is. And so I want to figure out how we can really foster business growth in my district and to diversify it, because we have plenty of liquor stores, we have plenty of corner stores, we have plenty of places to get a chicken box, you have your choices, but there's no place to get a healthy food option, there's no place to sit down and have a meeting, and there's no real economic engine along. You know, you mentioned Liberty Heights. We have the same issue on Edmonton Avenue. We have the same issue on Frederick Avenue with those corridors. And I know that the planning department, you know, is working to try and do some investment with Main Street funds and a few other mechanisms to invest in, you know, the facade improvements. But I think we have to go deeper. I mean, yes, we want it to look nicer because when, you know, you drive through, it makes you want to stop and check it out. I mean, we have some three of the busiest roads coming through my district.
Liberty those, Heights.
Yeah, and these folks are coming right from the county to the city and city to the county to get back home. So let's create an incentive. And honestly, a lot of those corridors really, in their minds, tell the story of our neighborhoods. And, you know, we tell folks all the time, the Edmondson Village Shopping Center does not tell the story for Edmondson Village. You drive in any of those roads and you'll see that people actually care about their community. So all that trash and debris that you see along that corridor does not tell our story. We care about this neighborhood. We're willing to fight for it.
So
it's about empowering people.
Obviously, a man who's chomping at the bit to get started.
Oh, yeah. I'm ready to get started, man. Like, and I've actually already started. It's funny. My wife has been like, can you tell these people you're not in yet? Like, because I've already gotten invites into community associations. I've already was at that emergency meeting at Calvin Ridewell related to the violence that spiked on Liberty Heights and Gwin Oak. Howard Park Association. And even with that, there's been some other conversations from folks that say, well, look, it's one thing that it's focused on getting the store shut down. But also, how do we figure out a way to really build bridges with these owners as well? It's not all about code enforcement and police, but how do we, you mentioned, like, how do we turn it around like Hamden? And actually, I met a leader who was like, well, look, there's a guy who wants to do more arts and music programming in the area in that corridor. So maybe we, instead of shutting the store down, we can have an open mic and try and build bridges that way. And those are the things that, you know, because his old perspective is if you look at what's happening in Station North, the community has been turned around via the arts. And I know it hasn't been perfect. There's issues about gentrification and everything that's gone with that. But I like where his mind is that, like, yes, we can bring the hammer down, but we also need to have the olive branch as well and say, look, let's try and work together as a community and have intentional spaces for community building and relationship building so that we feel more invested, that the owners, there's a connection between the business owners and the community. Because when you have those relationships, it's harder to still dump your trash out in the alley. It's hard because you feel like, all right, well, one, someone's watching. Two, we just had this great meeting where, you know, they want to help support my business and I want to help support their community. So let's build partnerships and build bridges.
Chris Burnett, I appreciate you stopping by the Center for Emerging Media Studios. Good to have you here.
All right, always. Thank you.
Look forward to continuing conversations. Christopher Burnett won the 8th District nomination, Democratic primary, off to the general election. And good to have you in the studio. Look forward to a great many more talks.
Hey, I'll be back. Let me know when you want me back. I'll be here.
Take care.
Yep.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our interns are Morgan Barber and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Juan Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Have a great weekend. Take care.